Hello, everybody. Welcome to Writers Drinking Whiskey, your literary happy hour, the show where every mystery gets solved and every bottle drained. I am your host and chief bottom of the bottle inspector, William R. Hensey. And joining me today, I am honored and thrilled to have SJ Roseanne with me. SJ, welcome to the Whiskey Bar.
Well, thank you. I love to hang at the Whiskey Bar.
Very good. And we're happy to have you. It's always open. So you just have to, I guess, click on YouTube and there we are. So I'll give the brief introduction and then you can, you know, take it away because anything I missed, because you've had an illustrious career. So I'm going to try to glance over it as best we can. But you've published over 20 novels, over 80 short stories. Of the many accomplishments, you've won the Edgar, the Shamus, the Anthony and the Nero Awards, and the Private Eye Writers Lifetime Achievement Award, which is always awesome when you get these lifetime achievements and you're still here. You know, that's you're doing something really well when that happens. And then your current book that we'll be discussing today as this releases is The Murder of Mr. Ma, which blends traditional, and maybe I'm going to butcher this, Gong'an crime fiction. With kind of Sherlock Holmes, the iconic parts of the Sherlock Holmes canon. There it is. Very good. And well, I think you had the other book we're going to read from, which was
Mayors of New York, which came out in December.
Beautiful. All right. So both of those, when this airs, will be available for everyone, and I'll include a link in the description where people can go get their copies. So the first question I'd like to, before I get to my favorite question of the day, let me just ask, anything else you'd like to add about your kind of author's journey, like anything leading up to today?
Nope. I will probably get to whatever it is in the writing department, the writing section. So sure. No, let's just go right ahead. And thank you for having me.
Awesome. All right. So, I'd like to ask everyone, so, and I read it on your bio, but for the audience, where in the world are you? And
go ahead.
And then there's a three-parter. So where are you? Where is the best place to get a book or get a drink? And then what's the most mysterious thing to ever happen there?
Well, I am in Lower Manhattan. The best place to get a drink, it depends what you want to drink, but there's a really good bar right down the street from me called Mary Lane. And they have all kinds of top shelf booze. And the most mysterious thing to ever happen in Lower Manhattan. Oh my God, I don't know. But it depends if you mean on the micro or the macro, because the other day I was walking down a side street and there was a guy sitting on the stoop with a great big bucket of small plastic bags of white powder. And I thought that is immediately right now the most mysterious thing I've seen. He's just sitting there with these little, you know, and it looked like he was selling them, you know.
Right.
I figured, all right, never mind. I'm not getting involved. So that was pretty mysterious. You know, we have crimes around here all the time. A lot of them, you know, unsolved still, and a lot of them solved. And you think, yeah, I don't think that really is true. But one of the most mysterious things about Lower Manhattan is that it hasn't sunk into the Hudson yet. So that would be my answer to those.
Very good. We'll cross our fingers you don't sink, you know, anytime soon. Awesome. So my favorite question to ask, though, is what are we drinking?
We are drinking vodka. I know this is Writers Drinking Whiskey, but I was out of my favorite bourbon. And so we're drinking vodka in a, by the way, Sherlock Holmes Baker Street Irregulars glass. That's my investiture, the Imperial Palace at Peking.
Very cool.
A Polish vodka called Wybrowska that is it comes with buffalo grass in it. Does it make it taste different? What can I tell you? Vodkas all taste different from each other. And I don't know if I like the taste of this one. I am not convinced it's the buffalo grass, but I like it.
Fair enough. You have to try that, though. I love interesting things like that. So the fact that there's buffalo grass, even if it perhaps doesn't affect anything, it seems pretty cool.
by Borovska. You can get it here. It's good. The best vodka, all right, I have to say this. The best vodka I ever had was in Mongolia. It's called Chinggis, as every best of everything in Mongolia is called Chinggis. Nothing in it but potatoes and water. And it's the best water in the world. So how could it be bad? That is good vodka. But you can't get it here. By Borovska, you can get it.
Very good. Well, I'll have to remember that if I ever make it to Mongolia. But you have to try that vodka. Hey, we don't discriminate here. There's, you know, it's writers drinking whiskey. I've joked it could have easily been writers drinking wine or winos drinking writers. Just the name I came up with. And, you know, I clearly like my whiskey. So so thanks for that. So amongst all the writing thing, I kind of like to start off, you know, a lot of the shows and talk about some of the other things you've done in life. One of which we mentioned kind of the pregame here is that you were an architect. And I think it was a firm that focused on police stations, firehouses, and zoos. So yeah. Go ahead.
We didn't focus on them, but we did a lot of them. We focused on sustainability before that was a word. We used to call it embodied energy, which, you know, is kind of works the same thing. But we were doing that. We were doing energy work and a lot of restoration work, historical stuff. And I did a lot of the historical stuff because I didn't care. A lot of architects care a lot about doing their own building, about having, you know, their vision realized. I was mostly interested in what happens behind the walls and what's really going on, which is, you know, the segue into crime fiction. But I was perfectly happy to be the spider in the middle of the web, which is what the architect often is. You know, this and says, I need to do this, and you call that guy and tell him that guy needs to do that, and that kind of thing. And then I love to go up on the construction site. I love to be there with the guys in my hard hat, looking at stuff, saying, you know, Tony, these are supposed to be galvanized. That look galvanized to you? You know, I loved it. So that was, I quickly became a spec writer. Anybody who knows about architecture knows what that is, and a field person. And I really did love it. And I did it for about 25 years. Writing. I didn't start writing, sell a book, and then quit. Because first of all, in real life, you don't get enough when you sell your first book, unless you're one of those people who get one of those huge packages, which never works out, because then, you know, either the second book doesn't sell or I just something. But
sure.
I wrote for 10 years after I'd sold my first book before I left the office.
Mm-hmm.
I was in the office for 25 years. And it was great work. We did do a number of police stations and firehouses. Once you do one, and zoos, once you do one of any of those types, people look at you as, oh, we don't have, they will hit the ground running. They know how to do this. And so they call. And so there's a limited number of architects on the lists for those kinds of buildings. And we got on that list firehouse we did was a restoration, because there was a fire in the building next door and it collapsed on the
sure.
That's funny. The building next door was a piano warehouse. So can you imagine the sound collapsing? But anyways, we did that one. And then we were, you know, seen as people who know how to do that stuff. So that's what we did. I did get a lot of inside information from especially the police stations.
Sure.
I worked with, you know, I was at one meeting the cops really disliked these consultants that the city had brought in. I wasn't fond of them myself, but the cops really didn't like them. And one of the guys, there were three cops, and one of them, you know, the consultant was doing whatever it was he was doing. And the cop just sighed, and he put his feet up on the table, one foot, the other foot, and this foot was wearing an ankle gun and an ankle holster. And I thought, you know, the consultant is like, what am I to make of this? You know, he goes, Vail, I thought it was the funniest thing I ever saw.
That was awesome.
Yeah, that was, you know, that the great thing about architecture is the people you meet and the things they do, you know, building schmilding, you know.
Very good. Well, I love the, because the police stations and fire stations are, and firehouses, right? They seem somewhat, I mean, it's public service, right? You kind of see some connection there. And then it's like zoos, like what do police stations, firehouses, and zoos have in common, you know?
Much more than you'd imagine. Although the clients for the zoo, if the clients for the zoo are the animals, then life is a lot easier. Once you actually meet the actual clients, who are the zoo directors and the donors and the curators, and the, you know, it can get really wild. But we did bird environments.
Okay.
And it was great. It was really terrific. And they were, you know, the clients, not the birds, but the people were as nutty as any private client. The police and the fire were institutional clients. You know, there were cops and firefighters on every job, but it was the city that, you know, you met with the city, and the people you met with each had five projects at a time, and they had been doing projects forever. But the zoo people, the curators and the director and stuff, they didn't do many buildings. So they were a whole unusual bunch. And they were, you know, the curators were worried about their animals, and the higher ups were worried about their donors.
Right. Sure.
But here's the best thing that happened when I, or at least, you know, my most fun memory was we were doing a bird environment that was open, but you had to keep the birds from flying away, so it had to be covered somehow. And we wanted netting, but we wanted netting that could have the biggest breadth without seams.
Mm-hmm.
And so I called a guy who provided nets for circus performers, because you want those to be without seams. So if somebody falls off the trapeze, he doesn't hit the seam, you know, which could leave all of a welt. And the guy came in, and, you know, to show his different weaves and all this stuff. And he was an ex-performer himself. He was
really
flying families, you know, the flying, you know, Zambonis or whoever. And he was a catcher. You know, his whole career had been spent hanging upside down by the backs of catching up. And they have to be strong and confident, you know. And when too old for that, he became a purveyor of circus nets. And we were sitting there, and he was, you know, with his Eastern European accent, he was telling me all about their circus and when you do this and when you do that. And, you know, I was ready to buy all his products, you know. I spec them, but he was that, you know, that's the kind of thing that I really enjoyed about being an architect.
Right. Sure. That makes a lot of sense. So you kind of mentioned there's some obvious parallels, right, with crime fiction and things. You're doing police stations and meeting, you know, the police officers and stuff like you mentioned. And then you said that you were still worked there for like 10 years. Was writing always kind of?
I worked there for 23 years, 25 years in the firm. Sure. Writing, here's what happened. I got this job out of school, because my entire career was spent in that one firm. I got this job out of school, and I got right away a lot of responsibility, and it was a firm that did not believe that women belonged, you know, drawing the bathrooms and doing the interiors and stuff. And it was really a terrific job. I had responsibility. The projects were interesting. The consultants were interesting. Everything was interesting, right? And I wasn't happy. And I thought, well, clearly, it's not the job. This isn't one of those cases where you say, well, you know, I'm not happy. I think I need a better job, so I'm going to go out and find one. It was obviously the career. It was obviously the whole way I was kind of spending my day. And as soon as I came to that realization, this little voice in the back of my head said, weren't we going to write a book? Which is what I had wanted to do since I was a kid. I always thought I was going to be a writer. And so I kind of got started, you know, at that point. And I had no idea what I was doing. I took a course, and I realized in the course of the course that this was harder than and more fun than anything I had ever done. It was satisfying in a different way from architecture, which was fun, but it wasn't fulfilling in that same way. So I started to write, and I had been working for about 12 years when I started to write, and I stayed working and kept writing and, you know, eventually sold a book and sold the next book and sold the next book and kept writing and kept working, because it just not only is it not as financially remunerative as it might be writing, but it's, you know, the weekly paycheck when you have a job is kind of hard to give up for the half yearly paycheck when you sell a book. I mean, it's little, and who knows if there'll ever be another book, you know? And I stayed working for a long time until I realized that I didn't have my weight down really in either place. And I really had no choice because I wasn't thinking, you know, and when I was at the office, I was thinking about a plot problem. And when I was writing, I was thinking, when I get to the office, I got to remember to call so-and-so. And, you know, so that was, you know, when I finally realized, a friend of mine that I was talking to about this said, what you're doing is you're still holding on to the rail, and you won't know if you can do all the fancy tricks in the middle of the ice until you let go and get out there. And maybe you can't. This doesn't guarantee that you can, but if you don't try it, you'll never know. And I thought, well, I do want to know. So I let go of that rail, and here I am. Here I am. You can see, as you see, this is my office, my living room. this is everything but the bedroom is what you're looking at right here.
No, that's a great insight too. Great, because so many writers, like I, still actually to this day, like I work part time, but I was a director for quality regulatory department for medical devices and things. So it was a very good gig and things. It's kind of that same, like, okay, I know this isn't what, you know, I want to be doing, you know, forever. And so I was able to kind of go part time. But when they offered, like, oh, I can do part time, just help out with projects, it's still kind of that railing I'm holding on to, right? It's like, oh, I still get it.
At the end, I was working part time too, because I had been there so long that I was the institutional memory.
Oh, sure.
The man who'd hired me had died, and his son was in charge. And he and I were the only ones who knew why you did something this way and not that way. So, and yeah, when they offer you part time, it's awfully hard to.
It is, right? Yeah. But it does get hard, because then, like, I think especially when you go part time, then you really, like, you're get that other foot is really heavy over there, and it's like, okay, I get it. Okay, I need to focus on this for this couple hours, and it's like brain's still like, oh, well.
Right, it's doing what you were doing in the morning. Yeah,
because I know you also you traveled a lot. What's the most kind of breathtaking architectural, you know, marvel you've ever visited?
Architectural marvel. You know what? I would say two things, but one of them really isn't architectural. There were only a couple of things in the world that were exactly like I thought they would be when I was a little kid and you know, dying to travel. And one was the Eiffel Tower. I saw the Eiffel Tower and I thought, holy cow, this is just like it's supposed to be. This is this thing. Perfect. You know, it's really, really amazing. So that was one. The other is not architectural, though it's indoors. So, you know, in that sense. But there is a apothecary in Rome that was, it provided the herbs and medicines and what all to the Vatican, as well as to the neighborhood, until it closed about 300 years ago. And it just, one day the monks just locked the door and walked away. There were other medicines coming along. They were no longer, it was a whole political thing. Anyway, they locked the door and walked away. You can still visit it. And you have to make an appointment and you have to talk to the priest. And then, but you can go up, they unlock it. And it is painted all over the way they did in the medieval days, in the Renaissance, really. This is Renaissance. Painted trompe l'oeil, people peering around curtains that aren't there and that kind of thing. And they've been peering, you know, for 600 years around those curtains. For 300 of those years, there's been nobody to peer at. And when you walk in, you smell the herbs and the flowers and the petals and the leaves that are in the containers and the drawers and all over that they just left when they, you know, 300 years ago when they walked out. It was one of the most amazing things I ever experienced, just walking in there and between the visual and the olfactory. Usually the olfactory is not a big deal. You have to kind of remember smells, or you have to go, what's that? You know, but this was astounding. So I think that may be built environment, the most amazing things that I experienced.
Right. Yeah, that sounds amazing. When you go to Rome, I'm gonna have to check that out.
Get in touch and I'll give you the particulars.
Yeah, absolutely. We're actually hoping my grandmother, who we talked about before the show, her family, she's full Italian, her family's from Italy. Both her parents I think we narrowed it down, they were born in the States, but both of their parents, all four of their parents were, I think, Sicily, you know, but they're so from Italy. But apparently, if you can trace your ancestry back, you can get Italian citizenship. So me and my wife are like, oh, you can get Italian citizenship, which means you could go buy property or something. You know, we could go like.
It means you can get an EU passport, which is not bad thing to have.
I hadn't even thought about that. That's a good idea, though.
Absolutely. If you can get an EU passport, it makes life much easier when you're in Europe. And it means, you can buy property, you can live there more than 6 months minus a day, which otherwise you can't as an American.
So we were looking into that, but that was like, oh, okay. So because when we've only went once, and we were mostly in Venice. And it was our first time. We took all the kids. We had to rent like big shuttles or have shuttles take us around because there's so many of us. And we're going around, and I had really, really wanted to go to Rome. But it's just with the arrangements, it just was going to be too much of a hassle. So we're like, okay, we're going to come back with a smaller group. And I like to go see the places that aren't touristy and stuff too. So like, I really want to go into some small villages and see the countryside and things. But I mean, you have to see Rome at some point, right? I mean,
you have to go to Rome. You can't not, but once you're there, it's so easy to get, you know, Assisi, where I teach in the summer, is 2 hours from Rome. And basically a small mountain town, although it's been a tourist center since, you know, the 14th century because of St. Francis. But, you know, there are towns, I mean, you sit on the balcony of the hotel and you see all these other little towns. And, you know, Italy is remarkably small for all the variation in its landscape. So you have to go, and you have to go to Rome, and then you have to get outside.
Maybe then we can transition over to some of the writing talk. I like to say on the show that with the name Writers Drinking Whiskey, I'm legally and ethically mandated to talk writing for a bit. So what I wonder is, do you write like an architect? And this may be because I'm not an architect and I don't know what architects do, but I think of it as kind of a very like systematic way, right? Like maybe you would build like, this is what the structure is going to be, and then build in like what you need, versus, you know, some writers will describe it as being a gardener, right? So I just have a sieve, an idea, and then I, you know, just grow it and water it and kind of see where it goes. How would you describe kind of the way you write?
You know, that's so interesting because I never heard that gardener image before. I do write like an architect, but not like what you said, because what we do as architects is you get an idea of what the client needs and the space you have to do it in and the budget, and you get a vision of what materials will work well and various stuff like that. And so you do a kind of overall thing, and then you start refining it. And then you realize that once you refine it here, that isn't going to work, this thing you had in the beginning over there, so you make it go that way. And then, so it's an iterative process. It goes like this. And then you go back here, and then you go around again, and then you go around to here, but then over there. That's how I do it. So I don't plot, although I do have, when I start, I have kind of the reason I'm writing the book, that is the big theme thing, unconditional love, or the book I wrote set in Hong Kong was all about doubles and duplicates, because Hong Kong was always two things. It was always land and water. It was British and Chinese. It was the mainland and the islands and so on. So it had two languages. So that book had two of everything going on. So I always have that. And I generally have something toward the end that I would like to have happen. And pretty much it does, or it has so far. If it doesn't, that's okay too, because the book will have taken on a life of its own and doesn't want to do that, so okay. Mm-hmm. But I do aim toward that. And then I just let the characters go. The reason I can't outline is because I don't know what the characters are going to do until they start to develop and start doing things. And it's entirely possible that if I said, you know, toward the middle of the book, the lawyer is going to fire his secretary, and it turns out that the lawyer is actually being blackmailed by his secretary, and he can't fire her, and not only that, but she's going to tell him what cases to take. It, you know, I don't know this until she starts acting weirdly in the middle of the book, and I think, oh, you have something on him, don't you? That's why you can talk to him like that. And you know, I would be happy to outline. Now I'm saying this, the Mayors of New York, a Bill Smith and Lydia Chin book, is my usual thing. The Murder of Mr. Ma, which starts a new series, is a co-written book. You see here, John Shen. Mm-hmm. John writes the outline, and he sends it to me. And I get these 16 single-spaced pages, which then we have to discuss. But I'm telling you, it's fabulous to be able to get up in the morning and know that you're going to be working on the second half of the scene. We're at the dinner party. Okay, fine, good. I don't know that in normal life, and I wake up with a stomach ache every day when I'm writing a bill. What am I going to do today? What are these people talking about? Who are they? What are they up to? What are they, you know, that's my usual way. This business of having an outline is the greatest thing since sliced bread, but I can't do it because, as I say, I don't know what these people are going to do until they start doing things. John somehow, my writing partner, knows what they're going to do, and then I have to figure out how to make them come alive as the people who would do those things, mm-hmm. which is, I get as far as I'm concerned, all the fun parts. I get the exposition, the dialogue, the painting the picture, the action scenes. I get to write all that without having to write the plot. But there's no way I can do that. So there's no possible way to translate this into this. But, I'm lucky that I have both. I'm lucky that I've been able to do both. And I envy the people who can outline. My theory is that they can access what's going on in their subconscious on a conscious level. And I can't. Mm-hmm. Wait until it comes out through the fingers, and then sure. I say, I see. Oh, I get it. So I'm sort of running around after my characters, and they are up ahead observing their characters coming forward. So right. That's good for them.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point, because I think there is that I'm working on this crazy epic absurdist satire I've been working on for 12 years called Pirates of Appalachia. And I'd written the first, I would almost call it like a zero draft. Like, I just wrote it, and it was exact, very much like you're saying. Like, I don't know what these characters are doing. I'm like, oh, they're doing this. And there was one strand of it that I wrote, and I just, as I was revising it, and I just finished actually, which was actually the cool thing about my trip back to Pittsburgh was I got to finish it back in Pittsburgh and Appalachia, West Virginia, where we spent a bunch of time while we were out there. But there was this one thing I kept like logically just going, why am I doing this? This is a crazy gambit. I don't know if this is going to work. I'm going to have to cut all of it. And I was almost done with it by the time my conscious mind finally caught up. And I was like, oh, I know exactly why this is there. I've known all along, but couldn't put it.
And not only that, but if you look back in chapter 3, it's foreshadowed. And if you look at yeah, it's amazing. It's amazing.
It is. Yeah, it is.
So if that's how you work, that's how you work, you know?
Right. And yeah, you have to find a process that works for your mind, right? Like the way you think. So
and anybody who says there's only one way or only two ways, even, you know, that just mm-hmm. I always go back to John Irving, who writes a book once he sort of hears a line in his head that he knows is the last line in the book. He writes the paragraph that leads up to that line. And then he writes the chapter that leads up to that paragraph. And then mm-hmm. he writes the chapter before that. And I've heard him speak, and he says, I never want to do this again. I never want to do it this way again. But it's the only way he can do it, so he does it that way, you know?
Right.
So, whatever works for you is what works for you. And there's no way you're going to make it work another way.
And you mentioned Mr. Ma and the collaboration, because that was part of, I thought was pretty interesting when I was reading reading that in the description. So first, maybe before we'll go into the collaboration, maybe you can give us just kind of a brief description, whatever you want to tell us about the novel, just to kind of aid the conversation.
Okay. The Murder of Mr. Ma. Do this once more, because it's a gorgeous cover, right?
It really is.
The Murder of Mr. Ma was an idea of John's, and it takes place in London in 1924. Two Chinese men they meet in London in 1924. One of them is Judge D. If you're a detective fiction fan, you might know Judge D. from the Robert Van Gulik books. Judge D was a real Chinese jurist in the Tang Dynasty, which puts him around 750, 800 AD. And so we moved him to London in 1924, because why not? People move to London all the time. They move Dracula around all the time. So mm-hmm, we thought he'd like it there. And in China, for a long time, judges did their own investigations. So he is the same guy that you'll see in the Choi Hark movies as Detective D. Okay. So Judge D comes to London to do this investigation and runs into a British runs into a Chinese writer who is teaching at the University of London by the name of Lao She. And Lao She was also a real guy, and he really was in London in 1924. So we made him the Watson, made Dee the Holmes, and they go running around London solving crimes and practicing a lot of kung fu. So that's the basic basic premise of this series.
Right. And where did you come to the term, not the term, but the idea to kind of blend? Because it's the, I'm going to see if I can get it right twice in a row. The Gong'an crime fiction, and then the Sherlock Holmes kind of, Holmes and Watson kind of aspect. And where did the idea come to kind of blend those two things together?
That is John's. The Gong'an is Chinese detective fiction. And what happened, John has been working on this idea for many years, in kind of as one of those, you know, I have a day job, but this is what I'm doing. And what he wants to do is use this series to tell the entire history of modern China, but all the parts that people don't know. And so, and I did not know him all these many years that he was working on this thing. The collaboration came about because about 3 months into the pandemic, my agent got a call from John Nee, who was a mutual friend of Alex Segura's. And Alex is another client of the same agent, Josh. So Josh called me and he said, I've just been on the phone with this guy, and he has a couple of projects that he needs co-writers for, and one of them I think is perfect for you. Will you talk to him? And I'm thinking, it's 3 months into the pandemic. We have, you know, at this point, we have no idea when or whether there's ever going to be a vaccine, you know, and I'm talking to the walls, you know.
Sure.
A human being with a project, you know. Yeah, I'll talk to him. The reason he was able to develop the project is because he had been the publisher at Marvel Comics, and he'd been laid off. He'd been furloughed, they said at the time, by Disney, because Disney owns Marvel, and they were making a fortune off the movies because everybody was streaming everything. But right. comics, the physical thing, depend on comic book stores. And nobody could go out to a comic book store, and so the comics were not doing so well. So they furloughed a lot of people, including John. So he only had 773,000 other things to work on. So, and one of them was this, which he'd been wanting to do for a long time. So we talked for about an hour and a half, and I thought, boy, this is a great project. This is so me. This is so right up my alley, except I knew nothing about London in the 20s. So I had to do a lot of research, and I knew nothing about the element of Chinese history that he wanted to bring in. So I had to do a lot of research. John is the most well-read man I have ever met. He has read everything and he retains it all, but he also, his mind shoots off stuff like fireworks, you know? So that was why I got a 16-page single-spaced outline when I said, sure, send me the outline. And I had to figure out what was going on, sort of do sometimes with him. But it was, you know, once I figured it out and once I got the outline going, I wrote the first chapter in the voice that was coming to me. John sent me a couple of books of Lao She's in translation, and so I read them. The guy was hilarious. He was really funny. He was either murdered or committed suicide during the Cultural Revolution. He was persona non grata at that point. Now he's been rehabilitated and everybody loves him, but he was very funny and kind of caustic. He wrote in the voice of someone who was a little bit clueless. And so I wrote in the voice of someone who was a little bit clueless, and I sent the thing to John. And I figured if he didn't like it, the whole thing was off because I couldn't change the voice at that point. But he did. He did. He loved it. And so there we went. And we wrote this thing. And, okay, here's the coolest part. There's a lot of kung fu. And when John sends an outline, it says, you know, big fight here, up and down the stairs, you know, whatever. But I don't know Kung Fu. I studied Taekwondo for a while, but it's a completely different art. And I thought, well, you know, up and down the stairs doesn't really help. And so we needed a Kung Fu consultant. I told John I can't do this. He said, that's fine, we'll get a consultant. But he's in Los Angeles. And the only consultants he was finding were people who worked in the movies. And these guys are like $10,000, $15,000 a day. So this was not happening. You know, we hadn't even sold the book yet. We didn't even know if we were ever going to sell the book. So, you know, you're not going to invest that kind of money. And I was complaining about this at a friend's birthday party to another friend. And I, because he was asking about the book because he knew I was working on it. And I said, you know, we have all of this Kung Fu and neither of us know enough to write a Kung Fu scene. And another guy said, wait, I used to study Kung Fu with a guy downtown named Paul Ko, Sifu Paul Ko, Sifu meaning master. Do you want to get in touch with him? I said, yes, I do. And I did. And I went down, explained what we needed. And he is, he's fabulous. Not only is it good Kung Fu, but he writes, he gets the spirit of the books. So there's one scene where a guy has booby-trapped a building. And I said, you know, the guy has booby-trapped the building. And Sifu sent back booby traps that actually made me laugh. They were fabulous. Because the guy is nuts and he thinks the bad guys are coming. So he has booby trapped this entire rooming house that he lives in. And as my guys try to go get him, the stairs all turn into a slide, which gets covered with sesame oil and they have to, you know. For the new book, because I've been working on volume two, they have a car. So Sifu said to me, can we put weapons in the car and have a car chase? No, not in this book. We have no car chase in this book. But I think we're going to have a weaponized car. It's a Bentley. It's a 24 Bentley. What kind of weapons does it have, you know? But he's going to put weapons in it, and we're going to have a car chase in the third book. So I don't know. This is just a riot. The whole thing is just a laugh riot. So
Right. Yeah, that sounds awesome. Yeah, I love that. I actually showed my wife right when we got it because I mentioned to you before the show, my wife's Chinese. So we're a very blended family, right? So it's she's Chinese. She had a daughter before we got married. I had two daughters before we got married. And so then we got married, blended that part of the family. Then we had our son. And so it's kind of one of those, the old show, like mine, hers, his, or something or other. Yeah. And so, when I saw it and it was kind of blending, cause my family, we just did the DNA. It's basically Celtic. It's, you know, it's Irish and Scottish and Welsh, like, you know, and then, I mentioned my grandma on that side. So I'm my dad's half Italian. So I'm basically like, you know, 12.5% or whatever, 25%, whatever, however it works out. And the rest was all Scottish and things. And I saw it, I was like, oh, and I saw your co-writers actually, he's a Scottish, I think it said on there, Scottish Chinese.
Yeah.
So I was like, oh man, that's going to be, you know, pretty close to what my son, is, you know? So that was neat. Was there any, so you described pretty well how the collaboration process works. I did like, I think the other part I thought was funny when his bio that he has a penchant for very long run-on sentences. So does he leave you very long run-on sentences occasionally and ask you to fix those and fit them in?
I do the writing and he does. Okay. He returns with stuff. He does the outline and he does the research. His penchant for long run-on sentences translates in the outlines to stuff that is going off into the netherworld. You know, and you say, wait a minute, that's all true and it's all interesting, but it has nothing, we can't fit it into this book.
Uh-huh, sure.
It needs a book of its own. It needs, you know, whatever. But he just sent me one today. He wants to mention, there's a historical figure in the second book. He wants to know if there's any place we could mention that the guy had a Japanese wife. And I'm not sure there is. And I'm not sure we need to, but it's one of those things that I didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
And I've, you know, read up on the guy. She's never mentioned, which I find really interesting. So maybe I can mention her, but stuff like that, you know, he just leaves me, you know, can we do this? Oh, could we bring this up? And can we, mostly they're really good ideas. You know, most of the stuff there was another one he sent me today that I thought, oh, that brings over something from the first book into the second book. That's a really great thing to do. Yeah. But I hadn't thought of it. So, I had to learn to work with him. And apparently, people say this who have worked with him because of this shooting off of ideas like Roman candles all the time. But, my first reaction when somebody suggests something about something I've finished, you know, like chapter 5, you know, my first reaction is always, no, we cannot make that change. It's too confusing. It's too, but I've learned to, you know, shut up and listen, because often it will result in something better than mm-hmm. what I have. We do work well together. Now, I think it helps that he's in Los Angeles and I'm in New York. So the actual working, most of it is by email. Occasionally we have phone calls, but we don't sit in a room together, because I think that would make us both crazy.
Right. It's like when you hear some people that have been married for a long time and they're like, oh, we live separately. And it's like, this is great. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. That's like Robert Parker and his wife who had, you know, separate floors in the same townhouse. Can't say that's a bad idea.
Very good. Did you experience any difficulty with blending with the collaboration process, just blending your two styles together?
No, except what I said, where I had to, you know, learn to shut up and listen. I think what he wanted, I think we're both really lucky, because what he wanted and what I was able to do and what I needed in terms of input to do it were pretty much the same and pretty much available. There are people who could not have worked from his outline, and there are people who would not have wanted to. But I was in the right place at the right time, and I just got a real charge out of it. So the collaboration is not. I've done other collaborations, but this one seems like it'll last. Now after book 3, but it really does seem to be working out well.
And, right.
You know, and as long as I can write stuff that I find interesting, I think it'll keep going.
I wonder, just getting back to you more generally as a writer, what do you think the biggest risk you've ever taken as a writer is?
Oh, I think starting the first book. Maybe starting the second book when the first book hadn't sold. writing is an inherently risky process, because you don't know if you're ever going to get to the end. You don't know if you're going to dig yourself a hole so deep you can't get out of it. No matter how good your outline is. The other thing about an outline is that's where you can make all the mess. But you don't know while you're writing an outline. I mean, I have friends who do outline, and they have abandoned outlines just like the rest of us have abandoned novels, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think deciding to write that first book as opposed to deciding to just stay in architecture and you know, do what I do or what I did, I think that was the biggest risk, because after that, changing styles, changing voices, I did another collaboration, which was paranormal, doing that, you know, all of that seems, oh, what the hell, why not? once mm-hmm. you've committed to writing a book from beginning to end, where you don't even know if you can get to the end. Right. So that, I think, is the biggest risk I ever took in my career, which was to start my career.
Very good. What's the worst advice you've ever received?
The worst advice I've ever received, you have to outline. That for me, for other people, it might be good. For me, I thought, oh my God, if I don't outline, which I'd written my first book without an outline. And then I was told I had to outline, and I thought, oh shit, you know, that's why my first book didn't sell, but and then I was at some event, and I don't even remember, it might have been a VoucherCon early on, and Sarah Paretsky was on a panel. And she had at that point written 7 books. I don't remember. But anyway, she said that she did an outline. And one of the other people on the panel said, oh, Sarah, don't say that. There are new writers in this audience who, you know, might think that that's okay not to outline because Sarah Paretsky doesn't outline. And she said, well, it is okay.
Mm-hmm.
Wait, it is? Is it really? Is it okay? You know, and then I was fine. But so, you know, it's a broader thing. It's not even, you know, you have to outline. You don't have to. It's the idea that there is a way, you know, because what happens is, and I teach a lot now, and I find sometimes I have students who just want the way. They want to be told the secret, and mm-hmm. they work really hard to get the secret, and they'll pay, but they want the secret. And when I was studying Taekwondo, I remember one of my teachers saying, the secret is there is no secret. That's the secret. The mm-hmm. secret is you just have to put in the work, learn the technique, believe you can do it, all that. But the secret magic thing doesn't exist. And it's the same with writing. So you have to outline, you have to not outline, you have to break it into chapters, you have to do it. Lawrence Block writes, or wrote, he claims he's not writing anymore. he would go away someplace, a cabin in the woods, something. Sometimes he would take a cruise, and he would lock himself in his stateroom, and he would write 10, 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, for 6 weeks, and come out with a book, and that was, you know, that was that. I would die of something. But that was his process. You have to do what you have to do and what you can do. And the idea that there is a way, that there's a secret, and you can be told it, and that we are not telling you it. Those of us who have careers are trying to keep the secret to ourselves and not tell you. This is not the case. So that I kind of went off the question. The question was the
worst. That's okay. Yeah.
That was the worst advice I ever got. And it was delivered as a commandment, you know. You can't do that. You have to outline.
Thou shalt outline, or thou shalt go unpublished.
That's what. And then, you know, eventually I wrote a second book without an outline, and I sold the first one and the second one, and everything got sold, and here I am. So, you know, that was not why that book didn't sell, that I had an outline.
Right. Very good. I wonder too with writing mystery, like, you know, crime fiction, you know, things of that nature. What drew you to that? Because I know you had some association with the, you know, building police departments, things like that. But what drew you to those genres specifically?
Yeah, it wasn't. I mean, I was already a crime fiction aficionado before Ooh, I like that word. Before. You know, before the police stations and stuff, I think it has to do with finding out what went on. And that's what I was interested in architecture, too. I like to know what's behind the walls. I like to know why that thing is shaped like that. I like to know what's going on. And I think that probably comes from a childhood where I had the feeling I was the only one who didn't know what was going on. I suspect now that nobody in my family had any idea what was going on. But at the time, I thought there are things going on that I don't know about. and I want to know. And in crime fiction, you do get to know. It's a limited universe, and things happen, and you do get the explanation. And that was why I went into architecture, not to design, but to find out what was behind the walls and what held things up, and why certain things didn't happen and other things did. And that is what I wanted from crime fiction too. So I was enamored of getting an answer from the early days. I mean, I was one of those kids who read they were in those days yearly the yearly Nancy Drew and the yearly Hardy Boys and, you know, all that stuff. I was a little too early for Nate the Great and those other kid detectives, but you know, my teenage I was 8 and they were teenagers, and so they were practically grown-ups anyway, but I was allowed to read them. That was what it was for me, because it was, they got to find out what was going on.
Sure. What advice would you give to a writer if they're trying to write, you know, crime fiction or mystery or something of that sort? Because I know I've talked to a few, I don't write them, but I've talked to a few different writers over the years, and they've sometimes struggle with wrapping it up, right? It's like, oh, I'm not sure where this is going. I think it should be this. And they kind of hit giving that answer feels unsatisfying, and they kind of get stuck there. Any advice on how to get them unstuck?
Yeah, if the answer is unsatisfying, then you don't really have the answer. You have a fake answer. It looks right, but it isn't right. If you get to that point, then what you have set up already is trying to tell you something. There is a reason. I always tell people that what they need to go back and figure out is the reason they wrote this book. There's a reason you focused on this and not on something else. And that reason may have to do with you wanted to explore the relationship between a woman and her sister. You wanted to explore what happens when somebody comes back to the small town they were born in, something. But there was a reason, and that reason should resonate in the end. And if it doesn't, you haven't really reached the end yet. I bring in now always when I talk about getting lost, Martin Cruz Smith. I interviewed him once, and I asked the same question: what advice would you give to writers out there listening to you? And he said the best writing advice he ever got was from his father, who was not a writer. He was a big band leader, and he would interview new guys for the band. When he'd hire them, he would say, okay, here's the thing. When we're up on the bandstand and you get lost, and don't tell me you won't, because you will. You'll be thinking about your date or your dinner or something, and you'll suddenly realize you have no idea what's going on. Look to the melody. Find out who has the melody, what he's doing with it, and you'll be right back where you belong. Look to the melody. And that's what I try to tell people. Look to the melody. The melody is the reason you wrote this book. It's those first couple of notes that put the book into your head that said, small town, haven't been back in 30 years. It's that.
Mm-hmm.
That's the melody. So find the melody, and you'll be able to find what you need to do to resolve the situation.
Sure. That's really poignant. I like thinking of that way. Like,
love that.
Yeah. Maybe then we can transition to some shots. you don't have to, you don't have to actually take shots. I'll judge you if you don't, but
my vodka is almost empty. Okay.
Bingo. Very good. So just rapid fire questions. So nothing too deep here. So are you ready?
Yeah.
All right. Better detective, Gadget or Holmes?
Holmes.
Holmes. Okay. Inspector Gadget has a lot going on. So, you know, like,
going on. Yeah. I just had to think for a minute, but I'm not sure he's as flexible as Holmes.
Yeah, that's just true. That's true. Definitely not smart, but somehow, yes, Penny and is there to help him out. Have you ever witnessed anything inexplicable?
Besides this one guy asking me out in college, that just still blows my mind. No, no. You mean like paranormal kind of? Yeah.
No. Sure. Yeah. No. Okay. Fair enough. Favorite podcast, and why is it Writers Drinking Whiskey?
Because you ask the best questions and I get to drink vodka while I talk to you.
Very good. Fair enough. Fair enough. The biggest failure, this could be writing or however, wherever you want to take it. Biggest failure, and what did it teach you?
Oh my God. Oh, I have to go over a long list here, right? You know, I don't really know how to answer. I do try to learn from my failures. it might have been something as stupid as the shot I took at basketball last night, which was really stupid. It was a very bad shot. I shouldn't have taken it. I didn't exactly land on my butt, but I did kind of trip as I came down. And I learned not to take stupid shots, but I probably learned that. I think if I really go back to this in writing terms, my first agent, who was great, but we stayed together too long. I should have left him a number of years before I did. And the mistake was... I was a chicken, and we'd been together so long. It was kind of like a divorce. And so I didn't do it. I should have done it. My new agent is great. I mean, we've been together years now, but he's terrific. And, my old agent, it was business. It wasn't a divorce, and I didn't really, so I learned to kind of trust my gut on stuff like that, especially in a business relationship. And one of the things that happened is when The Murder of Mr. Ma went to auction, and I said, I kind of don't care what the other guys are offering. I want Soho, They're better for this kind of book. And I was right. They've been terrific. That came right out of my mistake. So
Sure. Yeah, no, that's great. I lost my place. I had one more here. I'm glad you brought up basketball, because this one is basketball related. Three-pointers in the NBA, good for the game or take it to the hole, short stuff?
Take it to the hole every time. This the three-pointer, when it started being big, that was interesting, but now like everybody and his in-laws are shooting three-pointers, and it's a much harder game to defend. It's less interesting in terms of moves people can make.
Right.
On the other hand, when you get somebody, I have to talk Knicks for a second here, you get somebody like Dante DiVincenzo, who has suddenly learned how to make three-pointers no matter what, he can't. It's kind of a thrill. He can do it from half court. It is kind of a thrill, but I would rather see moves. I'd rather see defense, and I'd rather see that shot in traffic. On the other hand, I was watching the Knicks the other night, and you would have three players converging on Jalen Brunson, which meant that everybody on the perimeter was open. Well, hell, what are you going to do? Out and they, they throw the rainbow. Probably I'm a little bit bitter about the three-pointer because I can't do it. I don't have a three-pointer. I'm lucky I have a mid-range jumper at all. That's about as I get. I would rather see people who play like me get more play. On the other hand, we're getting games that are, score 140 to 139. It's kind of amazing. So the game changes. All games change. So it's still exciting to watch, and I still love it, and I still love to be out on the court. So,
yeah, no, I applaud you. I the last time I tried to play, like you, I didn't have a three-pointer either. I was very good mid-range, and I'm only 6'1", but I was good posting up. Even if people could be a little taller than me, but not really tall enough that I should be playing in the post. No, three-pointer never came to me. But the last time we tried to play, we actually just went with my daughter, adult daughter, and her boyfriend, and a couple like other dads. We're like, oh, good, nice, easy game. And there were some like mid-20-year-old guys there, and they didn't have enough for a game. They're like, hey, we could play like 5-on-5. We all get together. And against like all of our better judgment, we play. And, you know, you can never go soft, right? So it's like we're playing. Yeah, I'm in the post and the guy's forearms in my lower back. And at the time, it wasn't a big deal at all. But like for 3 days after, my lower back was just miserable. And I'm like, what am I doing? I need like an over 50 league that I can join.
Well, I will tell you that I play with never too late basketball. A lot of the guys, I admit, are in their 30s. But, you know, nobody is in their 20s. Occasionally, somebody's teenage kid will come and play with us. But a lot of people are in their 40s and 50s. And one of the things the coach says is, you all work all day and you all have to go to work in the morning. So please don't foul each other. You know, if somebody goes up for a layup, let them take it. So, you know, the defense is all on the floor. Once the shot goes up, it's like, you know, Where are you in California?
If you're familiar with the area, I'm very close to Pasadena. So I'm about 20 miles outside of LA. Downtown Pasadena is, if you've seen the Rose Parade, the Rose Bowl and all that, the mountains they show behind there, the San Gabriel Mountains. I live those foothills. I live just 15 minutes east along those foothills. Little town called Glendora. I call it the Mayberry of LA County. It was a little small. And I think the biggest business in the area is like 300 employees or something. So it's very bedroom community, just houses and people living here. So I deal with little place. So we love it, but it is connected to everything. So even when you get on the freeway, you're just stop and go traffic wherever you move. But, that's where I am. I'll have to look for one of those leagues one day.
Never Too Late has a program in San Francisco, but.
Maybe they probably have something similar around here. I could look into it.
Adult league. Yeah. Mm-hmm. 30 you can't play.
Do you so I think you were going to read from the Mayors of New York book.
From the Mayors of New York, which is narrated by Bill Smith, who is a private eye. And what has happened is he and Lydia Chin have been hired by the mayor of New York, who is a woman, New York's first woman mayor, to find her teenage son who has run away. And she doesn't want to bring the police in because she's involved in salary negotiations with the police union. And so she can't really be a hard ass in the salary negotiations. And meanwhile, they're searching for her son and saving his life and all that. Bill and Lydia are searching, and they've been told to go to Times Square and find a man who plays one of the Spider-Man characters in Times Square who take pictures with the tourists. So this is what happens when they do that. Did you know, Lydia asked me, that the first Statue of Liberty mime on the New York streets was a Chinese immigrant circus acrobat in the 1980s, and so were the next half dozen, because he taught other Chinese immigrants how to do it? This was not the random comment it might have been at some other time. Reaching the top of the subway stairs in Times Square, Lydia and I had become a two-person spring, flowing into a churning sea of tourists, hustlers, vendors, and costumed characters, including the Statue of Liberty. The statue, its robes, crown, and face painted the green of oxidized copper, stood immobile, torch aloft, until someone slid a few bills into the box at its feet. Then it would smile and lean down to wrap its torch-bearing arm around a wide-eyed child, or a half-drunk adult in a New York fucking city T-shirt, while their picture together was snapped. Once that was over, the statue would solemnly unbend and resume its motionless pose until the next bills fluttered down. I sometimes wondered if kids, or half-drunk adults, were disappointed when they took the ferry to Liberty Island and the real statue didn't do that. "Okay," said Lydia, surveying the scene. "I see three Spider-Mans." "Spider-Men?" "Based on what your buddy Rick said, that one looks too big and hefty, and that one's awfully skinny." "Who are you, Goldilocks?" "No, because that one over there doesn't look just right, either. Not chunky enough." Rick never saw him. He was repeating Mark's description. I gazed at the lithe Spider-Man scrutinizing the crowd. "But at least that one's not holding some terrified child in his arms." We hurried through the throng toward the empty-armed Spider-Man. It's hard to make a living squeezing tips out of tourists, but standing around produces no tips at all. We needed to reach him before he narrowed in on a new target. Spider-Man had just taken a step forward, his pointed white eyes on a preteen girl standing with two adults all eating ice cream cones. We flanked him, Lydia to his left and I on his right, each grabbing a padded elbow. He tried to wrench away. I reached into my pocket and took out a $20 bill. Movement stopped. "We need to talk," I said. Spider-Man grasped for the cash, but I stuffed it back in my pocket. I repeated, "We need to talk." He pointed to his webby mouth. "Yeah," I said, "right. If you can breathe through it, I'm pretty sure you can talk through it. I'm looking for Emilio Vela." The blue and red head shook back and forth. "You're not him?" More shaking. "Then where do I find him?" A shoulder shrug. "I don't believe you," I said. "Everyone here knows how to find Emilio. Look, I'm not here to make trouble. I owe him money. I have it now. If I don't pay him off, I'll just piss it away, and I sure as hell don't want him coming after me when I do that. Tell me how to find him, and there's a little for you, too. Plus the 20. I took the bill out again. "Where is he?" If this was Emilio Vela, he'd know that was baloney. But if it wasn't, it might work. It didn't. This time I got both a head shake and a shoulder shrug. "Really," I said, "we have to do this?" Spider-Man shrugged again, his huge white eyes fixed on me. I gave Lydia a tiny nod. She shot her hand out and yanked the mask off his head. Her head. Glossy black hair spilled down the blue and red back. That was nothing to the loud Spanish curses that spilled from the mouth of the young woman struggling to pull out of our grip. A passing family gaped in horrified fascination. The mother covered the little boy's ears, and they double-timed on. I waited until Spider-Person stopped for breath. Then I responded in Spanish, a remnant of the part of my youth misspent in the Philippines, where I'd learned to curse in three languages. I didn't curse her out, though. I told her I understood everything she said, that I agreed with most of it, but that we still needed to talk to Emilio Vela. "Hijos de puta!" She spat one more Spanish expletive at us, then moved to English. "Cops, let me go. I know my rights." "We're not cops." I showed her my card. "Mierda, eres ICE. I have papers at home. Let me go. I go get them." Any ICE agent who fell for that deserved to lose his quarry. I said, "No, not cops, not ICE. We just have to ask Emilio a question." She looked at me, and it seemed she might be considering the request. She held out her hand. I put the 20 in it. She smirked. Then she raised her head and shouted, "Tortugas ninjas! Cops, ayúdame! Tortugas ninjas!" Ninja Turtles? Seriously? But it seemed this was the Hey Rube of the Times Square world. The nearest characters, a Minnie Mouse and a Chewbacca, dropped what they were doing and marched toward us, taking up the shout to attract others. In moments, we were surrounded by the entire Marvel, DC, and Disney universes, and no one looked happy. "This is not happening," Lydia said under her breath. "It might be," I said. "Be prepared." I released my hold on Spider-Person at the same time Lydia did. The blue and red suit slipped away into the crowd. I made a stay calm gesture toward the circle of creatures. "No somos tortugas ninjas," I said. "We're not cops." "Kid and Emilio," Spider-Person howled from a few rows back. "Ice." "Not ice, not any kind of cops. We just need to talk to him. The Incredible Hulk took a step closer and said, "Go. Police is not welcome." His accent was Eastern European. "We're not police," I said. "We're looking for a missing child, and Emilio might be able to help us find him." "Liar. Police is always liar." And just like that, the Incredible Hulk took a swing at me. I forearm blocked the punch and drove an uppercut into his belly. What was I thinking? It was like socking a Tempur-Pedic. He laughed and swung at my head. The same padding that made him hard to damage made him slow, though, so I had time to twist. I took the punch on my shoulder. Stepping back, I said, "I don't want to fight you." "Police is always cowards, too." He started toward me again, but as he reached to grab me, he staggered. Lydia had kicked him in the back of the knee. I stuck my foot out, hooked his ankle, and crashed him down onto his well-padded ass. A moment of stillness, followed by a full-scale free-for-all. The circle of costumed characters, furious to see one of their own go down, charged in swinging. They seemed to be more brawlers than fighters, and the costumes weren't designed for action. Mickey Mouse made a grab for Lydia, but she wrenched away, and Mickey's three-fingered glove slid off. A lumbering Elmo waded in, yanking off his shaggy red head. He pitched it at Lydia. She swatted it aside, and it bowling-balled down the sidewalk. Superman flew at me. How real did he think he was? But I ducked low, and he smashed into Batman, toppling them both. They started pummeling each other. Bystanders love a good brawl. Tourists and vendors had gathered, and there was no question whose side they were on. I caught Lydia's eye, gestured that we should look for an escape route, as shouts of, "Come on, Batman," and "Go, Vader, go," filled the air. Lydia nodded and gave Minnie Mouse a roundhouse kick. I flung an attacking Captain America aside with no harm to either of us, but doing it put me off balance. An enterprising Snow White shoved me hard, and the next thing I knew, I was flat on my back. Snow White loomed over me, and mask or not, I could swear she was sneering. Captain America regained his footing and swung his shield high, ready to bring it down on my head. It didn't look very sturdy, but it also didn't look like fun. I put my arms up to absorb the blow, but it never came. Captain America jerked his head toward a new voice that bellowed above the noise. "Tortugas ninjas!" A stocky man pushed through the churning mass. "Vienen! Cops are coming! Go! Disappear! Idiotas! Imbeciles!" He shoved the headless Elmo aside, shooed some others away. Looking at me on the ground, he shook his head, stuck out a hand to help me scramble up, and said, "Come with me."
That was awesome. I had to mute it so I didn't, you know, interrupt your reading with my laughter, but that is a great, and you know, as someone that's had, you know, gone through four kids here, like the idea of getting to like just punch some of those like movies you watched 90 times in a row, like I like Superman and Batman fighting, like that's cathartic here, you know, it feels good. Awesome. So thanks for that. That's brilliant. So that was, and we'll include links for both. So it actually, I think it works out very nicely. We got a good reading from Mayors of New York. We talked a bunch about Mr. Ma, the murder of Mr. Ma. So
both read. Look at that.
There you go. There you go. Perfect. I like to say it's last call. You don't have to leave, but you'll have to restart the video. I like to end it with just asking if there's one piece of, life advice you'd give to, you know, the people, you know, watching, just maybe something small. This, what's one small thing they can do to make their life just a little bit better?
Don't give up. And I mean that, you know, on a small as well as a large level, you know, if your shot isn't falling, practice it. If you can't write anything today, write something tomorrow. Just chill and just don't give up. And it will, I can't guarantee that things will work out, but you'll feel better about them, whether they do or not, if you really, kept working at it. And usually a snag is it's a snag. It's not a giant wall, even though it feels like it. So that's... Mm-hmm. What I would say, you know, and see your friends, hang with your friends. It's really important to hang with your friends, and ask their advice while you're there. And somebody will say something stupid, and somebody else will say something useful. So, and hang with your friends. That's my.
Very good. Thank you for that. And if people want to learn more about you and your writing, where's the best place to go to direct them?
I have a website, sjroseanne.net. I don't know what happened to .com, but you can't get there from here, but .net, SJ Roseanne. And I have all the social medias except TikTok. I do not have that, but I have Facebook, I have Instagram, I have that X thing, you know, Twixter. Right. Substack, I have Blue Sky, and I have Mastodon. So if you can't find me, you're not looking really hard. And drop me a line. There are ways in all those things to get in touch. And I love to hear from readers and other writers and everybody. So,
mm-hmm. Very good. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming on. It's a real honor to have you here and to get you hear you, you know, read your work and talk about the new books coming out. I know you finished the vodka. I like to end with a cheers, but if you have an empty glass, it's not going to work so well.
Quite empty. So I couldn't do a major pour if I was going to be talking to you for an hour, you know, but yeah, so right. It's not quite empty. So
right. Okay, here we go. Cheers to you. Thanks for tuning in. If you have a subject you'd like us to cover or something you'd like us to do a deeper dive into, drop us a comment. We'd love to include it on a future episode. The show is a labor of fun, and it's truly a reward in its own right. But if you would like to support me or the other amazing authors I have on there, consider picking up a book. Any of the writers we have on here would be a great, great addition to your bookshelf. Each one is a master storyteller and just a great person to boot, so you'd be doing them and yourself a great favor in picking those up. And while I would never call myself a master, because that would be, as we said in the 90s, conceited, I do have on a pretty good authority from critics and my mom alike that I'm not bad. So if you wouldn't mind picking up one of my books, that would be great as well. I would appreciate it. Thanks again for watching, and thanks to my great panel of guests for coming on and spending this time with us. Cheers.